welcome everybody to come today. I thank you very much for taking the time to walk all the way up here from the community center, which is undergoing repair that we weren't aware of until it was too late to notify you. So thank you for coming, and we're delighted to see the Rosies here. This is our annual meeting, and we have a great speaker today. And before we begin, if you can't hear me or something, I have a little trouble breathing because I injured my back recently, but just raise your hand and I'll try to talk a little louder. As we begin today, I want to introduce the board of our present that we have presently. Our first lieutenant, first vice president, is Pat Pearson, who is unable to be here today. She's in Sacramento with her daughter. But our second vice president is Heinz Langford, who this year has become also our building superintendent. That happens when you retire. And then we have his lovely wife, Kathy Keene, who has taken on the treasurer's job and going through all the paperwork that you have to do with government issues. And our secretary and co-secretary is Tom Piazza and his wife, Mary Crosby. What happened was he was not at the meeting one time, and his wife nominated him for treasurer and he got elected, but only if she would help. And I admit Dornan, the president, but the other people that are really, really important to our board are Pam Wilson, who's our membership and available to take any membership and our archivist and museum coordinator, Bonnie Jo Cullison. We have, when Donna Roselius left to go to Fort Arford, who had been president of the History Association, Jerry Sirkonowicz took over as president. And in 34 years, we've only had Donna and
Jerry
as president. So we only have one past president, really. Then, of course, to me, with every organization, there's one person that keeps the glue together and keeps it going. But that, if that person isn't around, it makes a huge hole. And that's our editor, Gary Scholes. Gary retired this year. When he isn't cooking in his new kitchen or traveling for vacation or checking out all the new restaurants, he's helping a lot more at the
Yep, there we go.
So with that, I would like to open the meeting and call the meeting to order and have our secretary read the minutes.
All right, these are the minutes of the last meeting, the annual meeting of May 18th, 2014. The 33rd annual meeting of the Point Richmond History Association was held at the Point Richmond Community Center on May 18, 2014. The meeting was called to order at 2 p.m. by the President, Mid Dornan, who gave a brief history of the association and introduced the current officers and appointees, all of whom were present. The following issues were discussed at the meeting. First, the secretary, me, read the minutes. They were unanimously approved as read. The treasurer's report then followed. The treasurer, Kathy Keene, reported on balances in the accounts of the association. The main checking account held $13,033.92 as of April 30th. There are also some other accounts, including funds earmarked for various projects. Report on the photo archive. Gary Scholes, the newsletter editor, reported on the progress of digitizing the photos held by the association, which now number about 1,000. About two-thirds of the photos came from the Don Church collection via Alan Smith, and many were enhanced digitally over the years thanks to Thomas Mercer Hirsch, who formerly resided in the Point. And a slideshow of the photos is set up in the History Museum when it is open. Historic photo displays and plaques. Regarding the installation of the historic photo displays in store windows, Pat Pearson reported that she has contacted several stores and established locations within stores. Although her family situation prevented her from finishing this project last year, it is now moving forward and some plaques will be set up in the near future. These are historic plaques in some of the stores saying what was this building and so forth. Current activity, Mid-Dornan reported on various interesting items. An old letter from 1946 was belatedly received in 2014. Repairs and the repainting of signs were done for the History Museum, and the association donated some funds for the new Point Richmond map and sign on the corner of Girard Boulevard that's set up there now. And Mid also recognized Tom Kenny from Pinole, who said he wanted to be on the 90-year-old list. Since his birthday is in June, he was born in Richmond. Is he here?
Right. No, he's not here.
I'm not sure. She also recognized a couple of members who came to the meeting from Antioch. The current officers and board members were introduced. All were up for re-election at this meeting and so forth. The same as the ones that were introduced. Business meeting adjourned at 2:20, and the meeting proceeded to the special program. Bonnie Jo Cullison introduced the guest speaker last year, who was Dean McLeod, whose talk was entitled, This Old House, or How to Research the History of Your House. Mr. McLeod is a genealogist and a volunteer researcher at the Contra Costa Historical Society. He is also the author of two monographs in the Images of America series on Bay Point and on Port Chicago. Bonnie Jo Cullison had prepared a list of resources for investigating the history of one's house, and Mr. McLeod commented on those resources and suggested many others. This very interesting presentation was well received, and afterwards, refreshments were served. Respectfully submitted, Tom Piazza, Secretary. Thank you.
You've heard the minutes of the meeting. Are there any corrections or errors?
I have the map. Are you talking about the one that's at the corner of the park in West Richmond?
It was going to be a Girard, yeah. Right.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah,
okay.
That's the one out there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there any other discussion? All those in favor of accepting the minutes, could somebody move a motion?
I move to accept the minutes.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Tom. We have a brief treasurer's report. Kathy? Mm-hmm.
The History Association actually has three accounts. We have a certificate of deposit, we have a money market account, and we have the only one that's really active, the checking account. And our checking account has a current balance of $15,442.75.
Thank you, Kathy.
Brief enough?
Yeah. Well, you could give it to the secretary.
Tom?
Oh, okay.
Is there any old business? Regarding the roof repair of the museum, it's still in progress. There's been some glitches along, so that it's still in progress of being repaired. New business? One thing that was brought to my attention was the availability of docents on Thursday to get a place to park in the Point. Sometimes they have to park away and they get tickets. And recently, one of the people had to drive around for about a half an hour before she could find a place to park for the opening at 11:30. So I'm wondering if maybe we could contact the fire chief, because behind the museum is a parking area. They have it there for the, I think, for the library. And there's a couple of places for fire chiefs. And I'm wondering if we can maybe get a plaque or something we could use in our window if we couldn't find a place to park, to show that we were in the museum and not really going to Starbucks or something to use a parking spot. So is this something that somebody would like to help write a letter?
Who do you think we would have to approach?
Well, I think we'd have to approach maybe the fire chief.
The mayor?
What?
The mayor?
The city manager. I think the city manager handles that too.
So yeah. I live just a block away.
Yes.
And you know, while I don't really want a lot of business people parking in my neighborhood, I mean, it does seem that just West Richmond and just a couple of blocks up, even around the church, Thursday.
There's no place to park.
Okay, that's not my observation as someone who lives right here. So I guess my, so if there's a solution to work out, but I know there's usually spots in front of my place just to block it out, so.
Harry?
I go down there never at 11:30, never at noon.
Right.
But I go down there to one of the plants at the History House. And when I go down there, I just go a little earlier than the time.
Well, we try to get there.
Maybe if we can't get a parking space, we could move our time that it's open another hour.
I think that might be more difficult to do than try to find a place to park. I don't know. It's a thought, Mary. But we all
find the space for my moving my water.
At a quarter after?
Before 11. So if you opened at 11 instead of 11:30, you would definitely have a much better chance of finding a parking place.
Right, because you're right before the lunch.
That's something we can think about. Well, thank you. Okay. Is there any other new business? If not, we'll have our nomination from the chairman of the nominating committee. And since Pat Pearson is not here, our second vice president, Heinz Langford, will do it.
Good afternoon. I must say before I start this, be careful who you associate with, because in life, because by default, I ended up being in this position thanks to Jerry. Okay, the nominating report for treasurer is Kathy Keene, secretary is joint with Tom and Mary Crosby, second vice president is Heinz Langford. First Vice President is Pat Pearson, and President, of course, Mitt Dornan.
You've heard the nomination from the committee. I'm opening up the nominations now from the floor for the treasurer. Are there any other nominations from the floor for treasurer?
It's happily accepted to self-nominate.
Let me make a comment too. We are definitely interested in new blood, put it this way, or you know, volunteers to do things, because you know many of us have served for you know a number of years, and so we're always very happy to have someone relieve us. But anyhow, feel free to volunteer, or even during the year. That's even if you don't want to do it now. It's easy enough to plug in during the year, and especially when we put together the newsletter, it's a time to get together and talk and so forth. And so even if you don't nominate yourself this right today, don't write it off for the year. Just come forward, okay? Anyway.
Thank you. I want to interject a little thing before we go on, which is, I shouldn't do this, but somebody asked me one time how much the editor got paid. After I'd explained to him that we were all volunteers, and so they kept asking how much did he get paid. And I said, well, it starts out this way. We give him 10% increase every year, and he starts out at zero, so you do the same. Continuing then, is there any other nominations for secretary? Very good. Okay, let's go on. For the second vice president, Heinz Langford?
Feel free to.
First vice president, Pat Pearson, who isn't here but said she was willing to do this. And for president, here again, it's open. Hearing none, then I here declare the nominations closed and a motion to elect the board of directors.
I make a motion.
It's been moved. Is there a second?
Second.
A second that you accept the board of directors and you must be a member to vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Abstain? We are now your new board of directors.
Congratulations.
It's a marvelous board, and it's not hard to be president when you have a great board. Again, I want to thank everybody for coming, and the Point Richmond was really the origin of Richmond, historically known as Old Town. And the Point Richmond History Association came about with the weekly civic publication of this Point Counterpoint, and the book, This Point in Time, which is a collection of historic houses of Point Richmond, and illustrated by the multi-talented Donna Roselius. We incorporated in 1981, which is 34 years ago, and as I say, the bylaws have us have this meeting the third Sunday of every May. So again, thank you for coming, and I'll now adjourn. Now I'd like to introduce our speaker, and if the people from the front table want to sit in the audience. Our speaker is a native of Oakland and a graduate of Stanford. He volunteered for more than 3 years with the National Park Service before he started working the last 4 years as an interpretive ranger in the support of Fort Chicago Neighbor Magazine National Memorial in Concord and at Rosie the Riveter World War II National Home Front National Park in Richmond. For 3 years, he has presented the park's longest-running weekly program about women in the workforce. He's led tours of downtown Richmond, perfected the world's lowest history tour by bike along the Richmond shoreline. He's completed an 18-stop cell phone tour on the Bay Trail, completed an audio tour for sight-impaired visitors at Rosie the Riveter, and now occasionally turns to the development of proudly exhibit resources for Port Chicago site in Concord. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Raphael Allen.
Thank you, Mitt, and thanks to the Point Richmond Historical History Association, Historical Society.
No.
History Association. It was easier before I decided I could expand on the letters, and I'm not sure I can yet. Thanks for inviting me. I hope that my brief remarks today about making Rosie stop, or the end of Rosie the Riveter's chapter in World War II, will help to put the lie to the notion that only an insider can talk about something. Having grown up being asked to comment on all things black about as often as I comb my hair, I've been so pleased to find many other people who are studied in issues of civil rights and race relations who I trust and who I would walk the plank for, including our amazing docents, especially Pat Dornan, who I love working with every Monday. Likewise, when there's no one in the park of Japanese descent, it doesn't stop us from trying to humbly tell a story that we think people should know about. Yet, I have experienced often, and some of you as well might have experienced the occasional challenge, the occasional moment of log rolling when others might disqualify us from speaking about something because we're not of the group that experienced it. Certainly when I began my career as an editor at University Presses, and one of my assigned areas was feminist studies. really? I thought. Sociology of gender, anthropology and gender, political science and gender. Some would have thought I'd shy away from it, but little did they know that I had just years before designed and taught Stanford's first course in the history of masculinity and helped to write a play about black men learning to spell gender and feminism without dissolving into whatever sort of thing we thought would happen to us if we learned to spell feminism. So like a lot of you, I think we benefit from learning to think from our identity across other identities with empathy and compassion. The people in other groups benefit from our alliances and our compassion for them. We benefit from not taking our first or our favorite identities so seriously that we can't... We benefit because we are constantly being intersected by other identities. And if we can be honest about the fact that we are both and rather than only one thing, I think we're all better off. I hope that made some sense. Yeah. Okay, and some of my... some of my audience is head for the door after I say both and, but you're still here, so I'm encouraged. I like to say when I'm talking about Rosie the Riveter at our park, I like to say at a certain point after whipping through a whole lot of my favorite propaganda posters from the war, I like to say that these messages helped to call women out to do something during an emergency. And once they were out, boy, was it hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube. And boy, did we try. And today's talk, I have to say, is about how hard we tried to put the toothpaste back in the tube. It's one thing for those of us to cheer the fact that they couldn't get it back in. But it's another to say, not only did they try, but even at the beginning of the war, even before Pearl Harbor, there are many who thought, no matter how great the emergency might be for our allies, back at that time when we spoke of isolationism and our allies spoke of help, even back then, the debates were fierce that no matter how much labor was needed to supply planes, tanks, jeeps, and ships to Britain and France, we weren't going to change, we weren't going to depart from the normal because, well, we're in the Depression. And if there's one thing that an economic downturn often does to a society is that it hardens any of our identities. It hardens our convictions about whose place is where. Going back to 1936, Gallup began asking a question in its poll. Do you approve of married women working for pay if they have a husband who can support them? Keeping in mind that we were in the Depression when this question was first asked, take a guess what percentage of adult male and female respondents expressed disapproval at the thought of a married woman working for pay.
Nine
shit. Hey, let's hear them again.
82?
92.
90.
90. I'm getting goosebumps. The first answer was dead on. How did you get in? 82%. What were you thinking?
Frankly, I was thinking back to the fact that my mother in the 70s, even having worked, couldn't get a credit card without my father signing off on it.
Yeah. Good.
And it's
good.
Those little types of things that were ready, you know, and also that teachers and nurses' salaries were pen money.
Good. Good. You've nailed it, and I still have goosebumps. How fun and how frightening to talk to a historical society because they know their history. I should have started with a long cheer because I know you know your history, but even that couldn't prepare me for people going chapter and verse. But she's nailed it. Both even before the Depression, there were so many areas in which women occupy a lot of space now that were closed to women or open only if they didn't get pregnant or engaged. And even when they were open to women, as she just pointed out, the logic in many states was that a woman's wage was pin money because men would support them if they got married. A good woman should get married. This isn't me. Please don't throw your old produce at me. I'm just ventriloquizing history here while ducking. And that notion of pin money actually grew into a hardened investment for many men, in part because during the Depression, a lot of men had won a union victory, a commitment on the part of employers to pay them a living wage. As against the notion that if women wanted a living wage, they should marry one of us. By a living wage, they meant that a man should be paid enough to support himself and the family. So a living wage was also considered a family wage. And with that notion came a built-in asymmetry. Men get a family wage, and we're waiting for a woman to help us complete a family. It's not pretty, but that's what the wage gap sounded like in the 1930s. Excuse me. I need a 5-second break. I had oral surgery, and I think one of my stitches is... I mean, 5 seconds.
You want to give him a napkin?
Sure, a napkin. I could...
Yeah.
Okay, so far, thank you. So far, it's a case that it feels worse than it looks. All right. I promise not to unravel today. Thank you. So the Rosie chapter begins with what my son calls a red light, green light story. The Gallup poll doesn't cause anything, but it captures something. It captures the sentiment of male need and desperation during the 30s. If we guys are having a hard time getting jobs, what categories of Americans can we throw out of the job pool? Because our built-in assumptions about what women should be paid are undercutting us if those women are looking for jobs at the same time that we are. So one of the easiest categories of Americans to push out of the job pool during the Depression was American housewives. Let me jump back very briefly to an earlier period where there's something similar going on, not to belabor this new example, but simply to show a commonality between this idea of a woman's place and the place of the black American in the South during Reconstruction. A man with the most tragic name, Arthur Raper, wrote a book called The Tragedy of Lynching, in which he talked about, among other things, variation in the frequency of lynching year by year, particularly how it varied with the price of cotton. And he showed how, as the price of cotton went down, the number of lynchings went up. All I will say about, that's really all I need to say about that example, to draw a connection to this disposition that housewives should not be competing with men. The place of women became more hardened as a private assignment, while men were competing against each other for jobs during the Depression. And I challenge you to find, as I have, a number of examples that show that during economic downturns, the allowance we make for others to compete alongside of us often comes with a conjuring of something that's essentially different about them that should disqualify them. That that conjuring takes a very particular turn when we're talking about men and women, because we were not trying to assign women to another part of the city, but simply to the house. At the same time, each time that I say women here, I ask you to consider that the literature was referring to housewives, and it was also invoking woman as the pure ideal, knowing full well that millions of women needed to work for pay. Have mercy on their souls, said the literature. If they were only real ladies, they wouldn't have to work. They would have married someone and been spared this misery. Again, that's history speaking, not me. So, so this red light, green light story begins with this hardening prohibition against, or the stricture against married women working. And yet with the attack on Pearl Harbor, we'd have to change our minds. We'd have to pivot on a dime. And so the messaging, the recruiting of housewives starts out small. Just find something to do. Again, find your war job. I found a job right at the best. Find your war job. And then takes on more particular forms. And I want to find, and I just want to hold up one other one. A woman in cities, this is part of a campaign in 1943 and 44, the same particularly at housewives. At this point, the Office of War Information had learned that by putting the woman in the poster in her civvies rather than in uniform, it could more sharply and pointedly signal what kind of women we're talking to. After all, how many of us have hair like this?
Manicure.
Thank you. I forgot what to call it, and I'm glad for help. Is that the Penny or the Manny? I wasn't sure. Great makeup, I guess. She's clutching a letter from her husband, and the recruitment message goes, "Long Ain won't bring him back sooner, get a war job. We're trying to get these women to stop playing bridge and to do something for the war effort. But we're pushing against, one, the sentiment that we already sold them on, and the sentiment that their husbands, fathers, and brothers are deeply invested in, where proof of my success is the fact that I have a woman at home." This sentiment was important to men on every rung of the ladder. My dad in Oakland, well, even though he was only slinging luggage onto Southern Pacific passenger cars, felt strongly that with a $7,000 a year income, his wife still had better stay at home and we could just eat beans instead of hamburger, because that was proof that he was really delivering the goods. But during the war, getting women to respond to this meant also finding ways to reach those men who objected to women changing during the emergency. What's hard about the beginning, or what's elusive about the beginning and end of the Rosie chapter, is the focus on housewives, because it obscures the larger reality of millions of women who are already working for pay, had to be in the paid workplace. And then at the end of the war, those same women still needed to be in the workplace, even though some of them had better paying jobs during the war. The war gave them a shot at welding for 95 cents an hour in Richmond rather than waiting tables for 10 cents an hour, rather than being a school teacher for 75 cents an hour if she was lucky. But at the end of the war, those millions of women who needed to work for pay were fighting to hold on to those jobs while swimming upstream against a gigantic messaging campaign that was celebrating women like them for having the good sense to go home. Again, housewives were being addressed in the recruitment effort, and housewives were being addressed at the end as the women we were thanking and sending home. But so much of the messaging was about them, it was very easy to lose sight of most of the Rosies, who were invisibly toiling, doing amazing things, but who were less than the woman who was being celebrated, or different than. Such was the implication at the time. So what does the language sound like at the end of the war? The same Office of War Information that would call on women to find something to do. And here, notice, we're not calling women to get a job, but to get a war job, to do something for the duration. Again, if you want to bring your guy home, get a war job, not a job. The more women at work, the sooner we win. Women are needed for A and B and C. There's 12 jobs listed at the bottom, and in hundreds of other war jobs. We're talking about an emergency mobilization, which actually repeats the messaging and the larger pattern that we saw during World War I and the Civil War and the American Revolution. Though these wars are far enough apart that each time it happens, for many Americans it feels like the first and only time that women have done this. "It's incredible," they're saying. I have to add that because I still get phone calls and emails from women whose elders were the Rosies of an earlier war who say, "Don't you forget about us just because you have a new batch." And I like their saltiness. So here's to the... So with them in mind, I want to read just a small sample of the messaging from the end of World War II and challenge you to think about how the same kind of messaging met the end of World War I and the Civil War and the Revolution. This is from Willard Waller, San Francisco Chronicle, February 18, 1945, "The Coming War on Women. However the affair is managed, millions of women must give up their jobs. There is other work for them to do, women's work. For our nation, must have more babies or become a second-rate power. If we are to have an adequate birth rate," I have assignments for you. You thought that Diane and Jerry were just glad to see each other after the war. But people like Willard Waller were actually giving them a mandate as well. But I'm sure they're also really glad to see each other. "For our nation must have more babies or become a second-rate power. If we are to have an adequate birth rate, we must hear less talk about women's rights and more about their duty to the race. I'm getting goosebumps. This is not me talking. This is history again. The birth rate among educated, emancipated women is very low indeed, since few women manage to compete with men and, at the same time, produce their due number of children. Usually the career of a brilliant woman is bought at the cost of an empty nursery. The price is too high, even if the contribution is great. What do you think? Do you want to ask me to leave now? I've got one more from him and another from another article with an equally head-turning title called Getting Rid of the Women. But just let me back out of it for a minute to say the easy way to tell these stories at the visitor center or when I'm off-site and giving a talk, the easy way is always to point to the achievements. Child care, yeah! 3,000 child care centers, yay! 18 million women, yay! What else did we cheer back then? People migrated from the country to the city. Some people said yay, and others said there goes the neighborhood. 1,000 ships a year, 95,000 planes a year. Every one of the production achievements is easily cheered because we need 1,000 planes. I mean, we need 95,000 planes, and we need 1,000 ships a year. But the social changes were more temporary than lasting. And so we should ask ourselves, when we cheer for the social developments of the war years, when we cheer the things that the greatest generation did, we should ask how much of what they accomplished was possible because people knew it was temporary. How much of what we find hard to do since then is difficult because we're trying to do something that's more than temporary, that's more lasting. I've interrupted myself to make a long aside, and I apologize for that. But I'm going to come back to this question about identifying the temporary and then asking ourselves, what are we going to do about it? Again, from Willard Waller, the same article, The Coming War on Women. Especially in the period following a major war are men and women at loggerheads. This follows his saying, every American war is followed by a battle of the sexes. So he opens by saying not only this war, but these others before have led to this moment where we have to put the toothpaste back in the tube. Especially in the period following a major war are men and women at loggerheads. War brings about a temporary revolution in the relations of the sexes. One might say that women get out of hand. This happened in World War I and before that in our civil and revolutionary wars. But after this war, the women will probably put up a stronger fight for supremacy because this war's changes have merely climaxed generations of feministic progress. It's intense, but let's take a guess. What kind of things is he referring to? And here I'm really, honestly, sincerely inviting your feedback. What might be on Willard Waller's mind when he says, this war's changes have climaxed generations of feministic progress? When did women achieve the vote? Okay, go ahead.
21.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I asked the question, I forgot the answer. Please, someone. Not long after the end of World War I. Boy, if we had smarter rangers here. So women go into World War II with the vote, unlike the previous wars that we've mentioned. And so American women, like black Americans, are taking up the argument, you know, give us a chance to do something, while having another card in their hand that they didn't have previous wars when we were excluded, when women were excluded. Roosevelt is sweating when April of Randolph and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and the NAACP threaten a march on Washington in June of 42 because he said, now those Negroes have the vote, and if I leave them out of defense jobs and lock them out of the military, I'll have to pay for it come re-election time. If I keep women out of defense factories, I'm going to have to pay for it later. If I keep women out of the wax, waves, and wasps, or if I restrict their benefits. So World War II is different in the shape of its civilian mobilization, not only because of the way that war is fought at the time, needing millions of bullets and tens of thousands of planes and ships, But different also because of the political power of the excluded. And I won't go into that much, but I'm just challenging you to think about that, because World War II is largely considered to be either the war with the greatest civilian participation of all time, and I'm a bit too shy to buy into that ranking. It's also claimed, and I'm more comfortable siding with this claim, it's also claimed to be at least the last time that we ask civilians to do so much. And those civilians, to the extent that they wanted to do so much, those black Americans, those elderly Americans, those 200,000 people with disabilities who took on war jobs, those 16 to 18 million women who took on work during the war, including one of four housewives who took on a job before returning home, those people who wanted to do something had a bit more political power, as they said, I want to be included, and I don't want to be denigrated during this war. World War II was like the earlier wars I listed. It brought about an emergency situation. And the emergency asks us, how are we going to handle ourselves while we are in the emergency, while we are reconfiguring? You've seen all the tropes, the propaganda. Thank God I didn't bring all my posters here, but you've seen the black fellow and the white fellow in uniform just working together underneath Together We Can Win, and the posters that call on men and women to join together, from The Weeknd Do It to others. Consider how this campaign was trying to honor the fact that now our emergency labor supply came with a few more rights than they ever had before. And while they did, we're still sweating over the question of what to do with those women at the end of the war, because the best estimates were that 55 to 60 million jobs were there to be had at the end of the war, which was at least 10 million more, 10 million fewer than we could, let me say it in English, once the servicemen came home.
You have a deficit of 10 million, 10,000 jobs, or whatever it is. But there's more guys coming home than there are jobs, and all these jobs are for women who don't necessarily want to leave them.
That's it. You just saved them 5 minutes. Let's look at another sample of this messaging from World War II. Again, to ask what kind of debate is... How does this debate swirl around women in general, housewives in particular? How much of it is particular to World War II, and how much isn't? Just did that. Here it is. From a humanitarian point of view, too many women should not stay in the labor force. The home is the basic American unit. So speaks Frederick Crawford, chairman of the National Board of Manufacturers in 1945. A.G. Mesrick goes on to say in his article, Getting Rid of the Women, to raise in 1945 the issue of women's right to work is sufficiently startling, since so many women needed to work and were already working by the millions in the paid workplace. But that formulation, should women work, has its origins in the concept of emergency labor, a concept that was furthered by both sexes for many years, that women are, after all, an emergency group, a labor reserve for industry who are called on to fill in when men are not available because they are off to war. As long as this concept of woman's place in peacetime and women as emergency labor during war, as long as this concept exists, women industrial workers will be pushed around while they are employed, given only those jobs at the low end of the ladder, denied upgrades or promotions at the same pace that applies to men. These women will be paid lower rates, and when the war is won, they will be pushed out. In spite of its chilling title, A.G. Mesrick's article in the Atlantic Monthly called Getting Rid of the Women is a very progressive and sympathetic article. If you think women have cause to make the case that they want to work. It's a very sympathetic article that actually makes good use of its title to get one's attention, and then it marches through a number of conservative arguments and dismisses most of them. In other cases, it says, hey, women, you and your allies have something to worry about because we didn't go far enough down the road to make use of the political power of unions or something else. So it's a very sympathetic article. But he ends by worrying this point about emergency labor. And in doing that, Masaryk is taking us to the end of the war. Well, this is February. He's, I think, doing us a service by trying to get us to stop short of claiming that each thing that happens is a step up the staircase. And after that, each next moment makes us more modern, makes things better for women than the moment before. Masaryk is arguing, and I'm arguing, that the rosy chapter in World War II is a breach moment. A breach is an experience that exposes assumptions. It doesn't guarantee that we've locked something in and we'll always be getting better after. We only get better after if we can wake up to it, if we can mobilize enough people to lock in the thing that we hope won't go away. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. When I was in the sociology class, one of my favorite professors taught us about breaches as a way of figuring out what is the social order. And I'm about to embarrass myself by giving you an example. But he would have us go into an elevator and tell us to face the back. And I hated this, but you go in there and you just face everyone. What's wrong with that?
This is not the norm.
Yeah. So you might be thinking any number of loopy or annoyed thoughts. What's wrong with this guy? Or people don't do that. Or I hope he's not going to pull something. But it starts with, this is not the norm. Normally, people face the front. Or at the end of a conversation, you'd have us offer our left hand and say hello instead of right hand, and what should I be doing at the end? Goodbye. Yeah. So when you break small rules, you make people aware of the rule, and sometimes they get physically uncomfortable, and so on. And he did this as a warm-up to get us to reflect on larger rules. And he says when you're aware of a larger rule breach, likewise, you feel uncomfortable, you're aware of the rule, and you're asking yourself, do I have to do something about this? I hope these people in the front row make that guy turn around because I don't feel like it and he's bigger than me or something like that. But each time a rule is broken, we have to ask ourselves, what about the normal? Do I want to go back to the normal or not? World wars and the Civil War and other big emergencies, including each time Godzilla comes through here, constitute major breaches. There's something happening that's so great that, without question, most of us would abandon our normal roles. And I would even share cream of mushroom soup with all of you I haven't met yet. Because Godzilla's coming, and I hear he's not just coming to Oakland, my town. He's coming to the whole Bay Area. So I'll join forces. I believe in that together we can win, and we can do it. So there's something that was easy to buy into at the beginning of the emergency. We can't build ships fast enough for England. We can't get enough planes to France. We might lose Europe. So in spite of all the debate, in spite of all the resistance to hiring women and minorities in 1939, 40, and 41, gradually it became easier to make the case as the headlines grew more dire. The news became more dire. And at the end of the war, the same office that mobilized us early on by asking us to leave the normal and do something else would now remind us of the normal in other messages. Hence, Willard Waller saying it's time for women's work, it's time for women to have babies. It's time for Rosie to thank the man for her service and get out of the way so that the men can have a job. I'm debating whether to... Well, I want to stop... rather than walk you through my kind of scholarly summary of more of the ways that people said a woman's place is what it used to be before Pearl Harbor, here I want to try to subdivide carefully all those discussions about what a woman's place is because that played out locally. What counted as a woman's place depended on what people could afford to do in your family. even while people were answering that survey in 1936, 7, 8, 9, 1940, saying, I don't like married women working for pay. If the husband wasn't making enough money, he might check one answer on the Gallup poll, but still say, honey, I need you to get a little piece of a job, because we're going to sink, we're going to lose this house. Or, we're doing okay, but if we're ever going to move to the city, we both need to be working. So there was a public display, and then there was a private sentiment that our dollar's not going that far, and so whether you call it inflation or feminism or the depression, we both need to be in the job market. And that same private contract would rear its head again in the late 40s and 50s. And so I argue that not only was Rosie overshadowed, not only were most of the Rosies overshadowed by the focus on housewives, but most of the Rosies were also overshadowed by inflation when they made up their minds at the end of the war to stay in the workplace. There were at least three powerful reasons why women might have. One, I need to work. Now I have a better job and I'd like to hold on to it. I'm pretty comfortable calling that an empowerment argument. Two, we're not making enough money to hold on. And Frank and I both think that I need to keep working, whether it's a well-paying job or a piece of a job at the low end of the pay gap. And I'll call that the inflation argument. I was going to list a third, but lucky you, I forgot it. But most of the Rosies were pushed out of the workplace at the end of the war. In spite of their strong preference to hold on to these jobs. By the end of 1942, when the War Manpower Commission had surveyed Rosies about their post-war plans, trying to ask as neutrally as possible, are you going to try to stay or go? December 42, 95% of the Rosies surveyed said they intended to leave. December 43, 50% of the Rosies said they intended to stay. June of 44, 83% of the Rosies said they intended to stay. How much of that is empowerment? How much of that is inflation? I don't know, but the good thing is that if women wanted to do something, they were expressing a shift that was unmistakable. And that shift, as real as it was, is still covered over by a bigger campaign that now thanked the Rosies. And by Rosies, I'm referring not to all the real Rosies, but the Office of War Information ended the war by thanking the housewife Rosies for ending what they had begun. The message at the beginning of the war was, do something temporary in this emergency. At the end of the war, thank you for your temporary service. You are patriotic and temporary. The Rosie myth for the Rangers is that, all of the Rosies were temporary patriotic workers. Some of them were, sure. Most of them weren't. Our challenge is to find out how any of the women we know lived through the war. I don't want to end by saying, in point of fact, it was 72 and 28%. But more to challenge you by asking a neutral and rich question of every elder that you can. We used to make the mistake of asking at the visitor center, what did you do during the war? And what did you do afterwards? And that do is in italics. It suggests something extra virtuous about a paid job. But instead, you know, pick up on our lesson. Ask the women you know, what choices did you have? Or what choices did she have in 42? What choices did she have in 45? That's a lot more important right now than my giving you a summary of how the talking heads felt about women in 44 and 45. Sure, they wanted to influence all of us to call the women home, both the ones who wanted to go start families and those that couldn't afford to start families. But I'd rather that we not lose our last chance to get to know your elders and mine. So ask when you can, what choices did you have? And explore that. In 2007, population experts, a.k.a. demographers, told us that we were losing the World War II generation at the rate of 770 a day. We're lucky to have a few of that generation, and it's so important that we not glorify their lives in such a way that we lose the nuance. So I could put you on the spot, but I have home training, so I'll try not to. But I will say, I've had some really wonderful conversations with Marion, with Agnes, with Kay, occasionally while we've been in the visitor center, where I've asked, what did you want to do when the war's over? And I'm going to say, while I'm just closing up here, if any of you would like to take a brief moment to say something about what choices you considered at the end of the war, any of the three of you or anyone else, if anyone here would like to say something on behalf of yourself or someone else you know in your family, friend, at the end of the war.
I had to work.
I'm interested. Go ahead, Mary.
I had to work. I just got married and my husband was in the hospital in Oklahoma.
Okay.
So I had to work.
So you had to work. So you did
I
you
just
stay?
Came out here from Minnesota.
Yeah.
Got married. My husband was in the Navy. He went to the hospital. The war was over.
Uh-huh.
I was working at Police and Pirelli in Richmond.
Yeah.
It was a job. Then I got unemployment for 6 months.
Okay. Okay. And
I
then
had a baby. So now I really got to work. My husband couldn't get a job because he had a bad hand. He couldn't get a job. He had lost a finger and then part of another one, and they wouldn't hire him.
Okay.
So he went to school under the GI Bill of Rights and learned to be an auto mechanic, and then he went to work. They hired him.
Yeah.
And I wanted to keep working.
Thanks.
And I kept on
wanted to keep working.
Okay. And you want to keep
wanted
working.
To be a welder. I was a journeyman welder, and I wanted to keep working. And I went to the employment office, and after 6 weeks reporting to the same person, says, "I got a job for you, Kay." I says, "Great! I'm going to be welding again." She says, "Waitress. Nothing wrong with that, but what did I know about being a waitress?" And I said, "But I'm a journeyman welder."
Okay.
"Well, we hardly have enough jobs for the men, let alone you women. We became second-class citizens again."
Yeah. We've talked about this before, and Kay's telling me her story pushed me deeper into the literature, where I finally saw some scholarship about women in the wartime workforce that I completely missed before. And it was a set of articles that talked about devices that employers and unions use to disqualify the seniority claim of women by saying, "You have seniority with regard to other women, but not with regard to men. So all the men who want a job go first, then Kay." Oops, no more jobs. I see another hand up. Lisa.
Well, I just think it's interesting that in California, the experience of my grandmothers and grandfathers actually were moving from the wartime jobs to the isolated military establishments like China Lake, where both of, well, my father's mother did not work, but my mother's mother had been a secretary for during the war, and then went on and was a career secretary for China Lake Naval Air Station, whatever it's called now.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an installation in the middle of the desert, and a lot of people at the end of the war don't have jobs, and they literally, my grandparents put everything they had in their cars and drove out to the desert hoping for a job. But the isolation of these establishments meant that women and minorities had more opportunities than the women who were in urban areas like San Francisco and Oakland.
Good.
And there's a lot of that industry in California. So, but more in Southern California, I think, than Northern California.
I'm intrigued by the point, the comment you amplified at the end. Because I hadn't thought about desert bases in that way before, but by being fairly isolated geographically, a desert base can somehow extend the conditions that a lot of people thought only occurred during war, where a local scarcity would change the way we feel about groups of people that weren't our first choice for hires.
I, again, growing up in the middle of the desert, got to the Bay Area in 83 and frankly felt there was a lot of segregation racism that even in my part of Kern County, which Kern County is a pretty racist place in the 80s, but still there's always a shortage of jobs and, I mean, a shortage of good employees. And the base had to go out in the community and recruit housewives. My mom was one. Mm-hmm. Recruit Hispanic and black young men to get into work. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I grew up in a part of the state that was more diverse than many because we were all kind of in this desert town and had to use the same churches and the same schools. We were all economically mixed up because of isolation. But Lancaster, Palmdale, you know, lots of other places experienced that.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, I took advantage of the end of the war to get a higher education.
Yeah.
And so then I got a white collar job.
Yeah.
But what if you got the GI Bill? I mean, what if we given all the war employees GI education?
Mm-hmm. Agnes.
Well, it was a public school. Anybody could have gone.
Mm-hmm. So her what if about, what if you had the GI Bill? Might be interesting in itself, but the public school system was such that it was affordable to continue your schooling after the war.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your post-war move was similar to that of a lot of the troops who came home, some of whom did not aim straight for the job market, but went into schools, which helped the whole country by staggering their reentry into the job market. Mm-hmm. Likewise, you were looking to give yourself an upgrade before going for your next job. Okay.
I didn't like physical labor. I wanted a job sitting down.
Yeah.
How did you support yourself through schooling?
My husband, Sally.
Your husband was helping you.
Your husband. Okay.
The schools were also a step here.
Yeah, right.
College was essentially free until the 60s.
Yeah.
And you could go to the university, and it was less than $300 for your books and everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
fees. I mean, it's
not to eat and how to live. And
but I had a very a forward-thinking husband. He never thought that women. He thought we should be allowed to do what we wanted to do.
Okay.
If we wanted to work, we should work. If we didn't want to, stay home.
Okay.
That we were in a position with that we could do that. A lot of women couldn't. And a lot of women had to work. I felt sorry for the women after the war.
Yeah.
We knew we were working during for the duration. We knew that when we went into the job.
Mm-hmm.
These women that had to work, they were single women with families.
Yeah.
What were they going to do? Yeah.
I'd rather amplify your question than try to answer it, because again, because that question is one that we should answer, I guess, respectfully and with nuance for each and every woman. What choice she had, how much network capital she had to help her get her next job, her next apartment, her next horse or car, it really plays out locally. There's another piece of the story that's worth adding in here, though I won't go into it because I was only given 6 hours, so I have to be brief. That's the home economics movement. Even though it started in the 1890s, through the 20s, 30s, and 40s, some advances in the science of child raising, the science of early childhood education, hygiene, home kitchen and laundry in terms of family hygiene, advances on those fronts painted a different picture of household authority for women. And I say that because I was one of many people who thought 20 years ago that a woman who opted to leave the workplace and just start a family was giving it up to just, if I can repeat the Hillary Clinton cookies moment, to just make cookies. But what I learned in the meantime was that the home economics movement promised a lot of middle class and upper middle class women a chance to organize their authority in the house in a way that was far ahead of what it appeared to be before the war. Whether most women could cash in on that is another thing. But work like Miriam Johnson's in a pioneering book called Strong Mothers, Weak Wives talks about how women had learned to organize the home and to organize and to make claims on their kids and on their husband, on their parish, on their neighbors in the name of motherhood in a way that could call up more authority than they ever had before. There's a dark side to that, but there's also a positive side where, does this make sense? This idea that there's more...
Well, it's what the feminine mystique is looking at, is that there, what Fatty Friedan, you know, just a few years after this, is looking at that, you know, many American women, there are benefits from investing in the status quo.
Yeah.
And I think that the home economics movement is part of that ethos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Snoopy has said famously in one of his cartoons that appeared about once a year, was that one of the secrets of life is to look good at a distance, and the home economics movement looked good at a distance. It seemed to promise more familial authority to women, and many women learned to make good on that, others not so much. But there are a lot of questions about what women could dare to claim for themselves when VE Day came. How much of the temporary gains that women experienced during the war were gains that would go away? Once we regard even our favorite rosy moments as part of a temporary wave, then I think we can, maybe not happily, but at least soberly, take on some of the work that was left to us after they were sent home. I hope you'll take some of these questions and turn to your elders and see what more we can find while we still have them.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, Rosie, for coming. I appreciate you're here. I identify with you because I work for the War Department in Southern California, and I wrote to Serviceman, who I'm at, and just ended up marrying him and didn't have to work after the war. Thanks for the rest of you for coming, and we have refreshments, and if you want to stay and talk to the ranger, I'm sure he will help you. So thank you again for coming, especially. I identify with you guys. I'm not
even...